You're listening to the Autism Weekly podcast. Each week we share community voices and bring light to stories that increase awareness, acceptance, equity, access, and inclusion. If you haven't already, subscribe to join the Autism Weekly family. I'm your host, Jeff Skibitsky. This week, we're joined by Dr. Nicole Young, Clinical Psychology Director for California at ABS Kids. With expertise in neurodevelopmental assessments and a background in serving children from low-income families, Dr. Young is here to discuss the significance of April as both Child Abuse Prevention Month and Autism Acceptance Month. Dr. Young, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff. Looking forward to talking about this important topic.
Yeah, you know what? I'm excited, but at the same time, it's a topic that, you know, gives me a little bit of trepidation. I don't know that talking about abuse is something that is super fun to do, but it's important. Before we go that route, one thing I'd love to get your perspective on, because I don't know that we talk about this question very frequently, but I want to hear your definition of what is autism acceptance, because I think this will guide us in the conversation around abuse as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I think about autism acceptance, I think about two things. One, I just think about, you know, generally accepting people for who they are. But I also think about it specifically, you know, when we're thinking about kiddos and individuals diagnosed with autism, that they're recognized and that the diagnosis is recognized and understood as well. So not just that they're different, but that they are unique, or just like everyone is unique. And so being able to make adjustments as needed, like we would for anyone, you know, if they had a special need or they had an accommodation. So that's kind of what I think of when I think of autism acceptance.
Absolutely. And I think that one of the big controversies right now is the idea around, historically, people used to think that we need to fix the disability, fix the problem, fix the issues, where I almost think that our framework has changed and our mindset needs to continue to evolve to how do we empower? How do we provide more opportunities? How do we create the chance for somebody to contribute in the way that's meaningful to them? Is that kind of the thought process as a clinician that you'd be guiding your team when you're talking about treatment and acceptance kind of in that marriage?
Yes, absolutely. My team does a lot of the diagnostic work. So we are sometimes the first people to share with a family that their child is diagnosed with autism. And so part of that feedback session and part of talking about treatment and next steps is all related to accepting, understanding the diagnosis, but also understanding their child, maybe just from a different lens, so that they aren't frustrated with their child's behavior. They aren't lost and feeling like they don't know what to do, and that they also don't get stuck in what we were just talking about, this kind of idea of not accepting and wanting their child to be different or other. And that can lead to some difficulties and some frustrations down the line. So yes, first thing is just helping families really understand the diagnosis and understand what that means for the child, their child, but also for their family.
And I love that. I love the way that you're trying to be able to bring this new world together. My next kind of thought is that, you know, the idea of Autism Acceptance Month and Child Abuse Prevention Month coinciding, it brings a lot of thought to my mind as far as, you know, are there some intersections with that say, you know, part of the reason that we're seeing more child abuse with children who are unique or identify as autistic is because as a society, maybe the acceptance piece isn't there, or the awareness piece isn't there, or dehumanization is prevalent. What are your kind of first, you know, ideas as far as, you know, there's something kind of interesting about these 2 months coinciding right now?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know exactly kind of if there is a reason or a coincidence, but what you were saying is 100% true, that children with special needs are at significantly higher risk of being abused or mistreated. And having a better understanding and acceptance of those special needs, autism in particular, can help in recognizing the reasons for the behavior. And so instead of getting frustrated with a child that may be engaging in some type of repetitive behavior, so they're doing something over and over again, for a child with autism, that might be comforting for them and soothing. But if an adult, or maybe a peer, does not understand the reason for the behavior, the adult may try to extinguish that behavior, get rid of it, punish it. And so, yes, the two coinciding kind of works out in a, like you said, kind of uncomfortable discussion, but in an important discussion.
And just recently in Colorado, we ran into a horrifying incident. And it was on a bus where somebody was pretty brutally abused. And in that context, it makes me think that there's a lot of things that we missed out on as a society that created an environment where this could occur. And maybe you can give us a little bit of background, because I know that you also read through some of that story, but maybe we can use that as context to start breaking down some of the challenges that we have to make sure that we're protecting those individuals who might need some of our ability to create some safe space.
Yes, yes, absolutely. You know, in particular with this child was nonverbal. And that is something that we see with some individuals on the autism spectrum, is they can maybe communicate, but they don't verbally communicate. And so, unfortunately, it's harder for them to report when they get home from school, "Mom, on the bus, this happened." And so the family is kind of left with being a little bit investigators of their own, of like, why does they have a bruise on their shoulder? Well, I know my kid trips a lot, so maybe he just tripped at school. So I think that key factor here is that this child couldn't come home and say, "Mom, on the bus, this is happening to me," or, "Dad, at school, this is happening to me." So giving children opportunities and ways to communicate is really, really helpful. And accepting and understanding their diagnosis, getting them into treatment so that they do have ways to communicate, is really, really very helpful, because these kids are at higher risk because they can't share verbally what happened.
Now, as a psychologist, is that I would imagine part of what you're trying to be able to do is not just empower families, you're also helping to kind of work with the community and give some understanding as far as, you know, this is something that this child brings to the community. It might be something different. It could be a plus in the view of that particular community member, or it could be something that they've never crossed paths with and they're going to respond to. This situation of abuse is one that was horrific, but there are times where people don't know how to engage. They look at a behavior, like you mentioned, hand flapping, and they see it as potentially aggressive. Like, what is it that we need to do as clinical members within a community to start that education process so that we have more understanding? We have folks that can look at a unique difference of an individual and accept it versus be fearful of it, or try and say that, you know, you can't do that, hold them back, which creates this animosity or this anger or more frustration from a situation.
Right. Yeah. I mean, first step is identifying and diagnosing. So if we don't know what is going on, if we don't understand the reason for the behaviors, then the family, the school system, they're kind of left confused, and they might start to interpret it from their lens, that may be more punitive, maybe more negative. So I would say first step is just identifying and diagnosing. But in order to do that, it's getting community members, pediatricians, teachers, those that work with children in daycare settings, to be more aware of the signs and symptoms. And unfortunately, in some areas, we've gotten a little bit pigeonholed in what we think of when we think of autism. We maybe think of the child that's nonverbal, that is hand flapping, and that lines up their toys and plays by themselves. But that's not autism. That's a child who is diagnosed with autism, but autism is a spectrum for a reason. So really being able to understand the spectrum, And something that I know we've tried to do and I've tried to do is meet with pediatricians to talk about all the different signs and symptoms that are out there. Because, you know, I do hear from families, I went to my pediatrician or I went to the teacher and I said, can you do an evaluation? I think my child has autism. And the response that the families sometimes get is, oh, no, your child doesn't have autism. But that's just because we're thinking about it from kind of a narrow lens.
Absolutely. And I mean, one of the other components, I think, is working with clinicians, is that when you look at clinical processes, one of the downfalls that has occurred over time is that we talk about autonomy and we're trying to build that for our clients, for these young children. We're trying to give them the chance to be able to voice their own opinion, to be able to communicate with the world around them. But at times we restrict that because we're making decisions that are better for us at the moment versus better for the child long term. When you're trying to be able to navigate this and talking with parents about, you know, how can we create a household where your child feels like they have a voice, a place, and that what they're doing isn't always wrong, at the same time as skill building.
Yes.
What's the balance on that?
Yeah, you know, one thing that I think is tough when we think about families is there's a lot going on in all families. And so, you know, sometimes we get parents where they may have a child that has some different special needs, and those special needs are more kind of interfering and more causing more problems at the home. And their child who's diagnosed with autism may be content on their own, maybe quiet, maybe okay, you know, playing on their own. So they're not giving that child the tools to communicate, maybe the tools to engage more. And so then when that child does transition into different environments, they're not equipped with those tools. So, you know, helping families recognize that, you know, just because the absence of externalizing behaviors, you know, the kicking, the screaming, the tantrums, doesn't mean that, you know, your child doesn't have needs and doesn't need kind of that attention and support. So setting up the environment so that all kids have access, good and bad, you know, to different types of tools, technologies, skills, opportunities to explore their environment, can be really, really helpful. And then we might become more aware that a change has occurred. So if we're paying more attention, if we're more aware to the child, we might notice, wait, where did that bruise come from? Or wait, your behavior is really different today. What's going on? What's different? So the more we're engaging, the more we're connecting, I think the more we can be paying attention to everything that's going on with our kids.
No, and I definitely appreciate that. And that skill piece, I think, is so important, because if we can give the communicative skills for a child to not only be able to communicate when they're feeling displeasure, but how to advocate for themselves, how to make sure that they have that possibility, it does reduce some of that susceptibility to abuse. But let's talk about it. You mentioned, I mean, that, you know, sometimes is that there's bruises. Sometimes you might see a child withdrawal. It's got to be tough when you have a child who maybe withdrawing is part of who they are, is that's their comfort zone, or maybe they are self-injurious and they have their own sets of bruises. How can a family make sure that, you know, when I have my child go out in the community, when I feel like they need to be in a safe place with others, that I can still feel confident that nobody is treating them in a way that I wouldn't feel good about, or that could potentially cause harm to them?
Yes, absolutely. You know, one of the key things when we're thinking about identifying signs or symptoms of abuse is a change in behavior. So if you have a child that prefers to withdraw and is on their own frequently, that's different than a child that's very social and likes being around and likes being with other people and now is choosing to isolate more. Same thing, if you have a child that engages in some self-injurious behavior, they bang their head or maybe they bite on their fingers or their arms, that's different than all of a sudden they come home from school or they come home from daycare and now you're noticing bruising. And in some of the areas where it's a little bit more suspicious, if you're seeing bruises, are areas like the neck, the upper thigh, the upper arm, face. So those are areas, kind of, if you're noticing the bruising there, that's definitely something to kind of pay attention to and be more aware of. You know, the other thing I would share is, you know, some of our individuals, you know, on the autism spectrum are a little bit later to potty train at times. Developmentally, you know, we just see some delays, so they may be in diapers for longer. So if you are, you know, helping a child with changing or wiping them and you're noticing bruises on their bottom, that's also a sign and kind of something to be aware of. So there are some areas where they may be more susceptible, but then some areas where we just want to make sure we're monitoring all children for those marks.
Yeah, as you were talking through that, and I mean, sometimes those physical marks are and physical abuse is sometimes easier to catch, not always.
Yeah.
But as you were going through that, it kept popping in my mind, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for emotional abuse. There's a lot of susceptibility for somebody to be treated in a way that it shows less value, which is just as harmful. When you're kind of working with and you work with clinicians, you coach schools, there's a lot of people that come in and out of a child's life. What are some of the things that you'd be saying, you know, in all environments, we need to make sure that we're focusing on these core characteristics to make sure that we're providing a safe emotional space for that child?
Yeah, I mean, I say this a lot, is understanding and recognition. I mean, so really going back to that acceptance, right? If we understand the child and we understand their behavior, then we can provide them tools. Also for providers, families, to learn skills so that they can better support their child and they can better manage the behavior, as opposed to getting frustrated that their child's engaging in a behavior that they don't like, or this child's disrupting the classroom. What am I going to do about it? I'm going to isolate them in the corner. What am I going to do about it? I'm going to smack them in the face because I want them to stop making that noise. It does go back to a lot of this acceptance and understanding, so that not only is the child accepted for who they are, but the adults in their lives understand how to work with that child and how to support that child. Maybe we give them something they can chew on. You know, maybe we give them so they're not making noises in the classroom that's disruptive, but there's something that they can engage in that's, you know, meaningful for them, that's serving that purpose. And that's where really understanding the reason for the behavior is helpful in coming up with the solutions and the supports.
Yeah, I mean, providing parents the tools and the education, and also probably the emotional support themselves, whether that's being a part of a community group or maybe talking to a psychologist or a therapist. And, you know, there are going to be times where your buttons are going to be pushed. Patience is such a hard skill to be able to show 24/7. So it's like, okay, what are my own coping mechanisms? How do I work through that? And within treatment, which is all about empowerment, one of the biggest things is the parent education. But a lot of what we're talking about also sounds like it's about skill development. So what kind of role does early intervention, what does that play in the prevention of abuse as the child starts to develop and become older? Is there a correlation to a good base in early intervention to future success with self-advocacy?
Yeah, I mean, with this, I think there's two pieces too. One is just, you know, when kids are little, they're home a lot. They don't have exposure to a lot of other individuals potentially. And then kids with special needs sometimes don't get put in schools, or they get put in non-traditional school type settings. So just having a professional that can be in contact with the child and work with the child on a regular basis can help with the identifying of the signs. So that's kind of not quite the prevention, but that's just kind of having that professional there can be really helpful. And I know during COVID, it was a lot more kids were at higher risk because they were home. There wasn't that professional working with them one-on-one. They weren't going to school. So part of it is just having someone there that can really be the eyes and the ears for some of these kiddos and help them, you know, to communicate. but also just for parents, you know, to learn skills and learn strategies and learn tools. So to learn, what can I do? How can I help my child if they are engaging one of these behaviors? How can I redirect them? Are there some non-physical ways that we can do some type of restraint or redirection that might not be on the top of parents' minds? You know, maybe they were raised a certain way and this is how you dealt with behaviors. But now they have a child with autism, and we just want to learn new tools to help support. Again, it's both. It's the parents and the kid to kind of help support them together.
Absolutely. And autism is it's a journey. I mean, it's like any sort of self-exploration. If you're an autistic individual, is that you're going to go through the same path of trying to figure out, how do I develop the ways to be able to integrate into communities I want to be a part of? How do I develop those skills? But that requires is that the treatment is being embedded across your life. It's not just, you know, the only place I'm going to do it is in the home environment, is that that people need to be educated in the school system, and that support needs to be there in the school system. This bus driver probably needed extra support on their bus. Not that anything could be forgiven for what they did, but we could be providing additional support there and providing the guidance and the effort to be able to empower the entire community that way. So throughout this journey, it sounds like that early intervention piece, or even treatment in general, it needs to be where that child's going to benefit from it at any given stage of their life, and it needs to follow them. Is that empowerment piece in creating a community, is that one of kind of the guiding factors to creating safe spaces and making that safe space communal? Like, everywhere should be a safe space.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And I think when we're thinking about early intervention and parent training, the more the parent can hear and practice and really kind of incorporate the tools into their life, into their parenting skills. A lot of times that we work with little kids who aren't in school yet. And so parents will ask questions about, well, what should I do when they go to kindergarten? What should I do when they go to first grade? And, you know, we recommend, take the tools that you've learned in early intervention, take the tools that you have found that have worked for you and your child, and share those tools with your school, because the school might not have all the same tools. They might have different tools, but they might not have the same ones that you have found that work with your child really well. So, and I would say the same thing when we're thinking about other communities. When the kid goes to camp, share those tools with a camp counselor. Share those tools when you go on vacation and you you know, meet other families and everyone's at the pool. Share some of those tools. Hey, you know what? He likes to splash around a bit. This is what he really enjoys. So accept, it goes back to that acceptance, right? If we're accepting the child's behavior and we're accepting them for who they are, instead of saying, no, don't splash, we're at a pool, don't splash, recognizing, all right, we're going to splash a little bit, and now we're going to use some of our tools to transition to something different so that we're not soaking everyone around us.
Yeah, I mean, empowering that that parent professional almost to be able to advocate for their child when their child can't self-advocate, it's so valuable. But there's got to be other resources out there. I mean, what resources would you be turning to be able to help inform people on autism acceptance within communities, within schools?
You know, I think kind of local Autism Society websites are really helpful, because they share examples, they share stories, but there also are a lot of meetup groups and meetup opportunities. I know that just kind of in thinking of autism acceptance and child abuse prevention, I was looking at the Autism Speaks website, and they do have a whole section about you know, child abuse prevention and how to identify signs and symptoms and what to do and who to call. So part of it is just learning about both, right? Learning about, what should I be aware of from a parent perspective that my child may be at risk? What should I learn from a parent perspective on different parenting skills and strategies that I can use so that I'm not overwhelmed? Are there resources that can help support me? But then also, you know, just understanding autism, understanding the diagnosis, understanding the signs and symptoms so they're not misinterpreted.
Absolutely. And I would imagine, at least from my point of view, for the clinical side, it's knowing what community-informed practice is, knowing what advocates are telling us and embedding that into treatment, respecting somebody and using something that's more neurodivergent affirming or assent-based care and using that more effectively during treatment. But are there specific steps to make sure that you and I as individuals, or anybody out there as an individual, can become a better advocate for child abuse prevention? Or, I mean, are there clear-cut things that we should be doing on a regular basis to make sure that we're keeping people safe?
I mean, part of working with children, at least in the state of California, which is where I am, is we're mandated reporters. So just educating on the signs and the symptoms and educating on, how to make a report and, you don't need to be scared. We're here to kind of keep the child safe is really important. I think that kind of a cliche thing, but if you see something, say something, applies in this situation as well. Right? If you see that a child is being mistreated, maybe they can't advocate for themselves. So saying something can be really, really helpful in potentially preventing that in the future. We want to recognize that everyone's, we want to hope that everyone's doing their best, right? We want to hope that people are trying to keep their kids safe. Maybe they have to grab their arm when they run in the street because we have a kid that elopes and runs. And so we want to balance, right, our judgments with also kind of keeping the kids safe. And that can be difficult, but that's where education really helps.
And I think I mean, you've said it was cliche, but knowing those core points and just kind of keeping it as part of what you're doing on a regular basis, it automatically is creating a safer environment. I think personally is that I'm a strong believer that the lack of acceptance could be abuse on itself. Is that, if we are dehumanizing somebody's qualities and telling them that who they are is wrong, that could be somewhat abusive. So in the field of psychology, there's been a lot of movement of trying to say we can take all of these disciplines. We can take psychotherapy, we can take ABA, we can take all of these different therapeutic models and have a lens towards empowerment and acceptance and doing that correctly. Is there something in the field right now that you're more excited about that's looking at that acceptance piece?
Yeah, I mean, I think going back to your point too on, kind of the acceptance can help to buffer some kind of more serious issues down the line. So I'm definitely interested in the early identification of autism because I also sometimes see teenagers who the diagnosis hasn't been identified or been missed. And now they are at risk of developing some other kind of mental health concerns like anxiety or depression because it wasn't identified early and we didn't accept it, right? So the kiddos always said, I feel different. I don't like doing it that way. I like doing it this way. And whether it's from the parents, pediatricians, schools, professionals, et cetera, mental health professionals that are saying, no, let's fix it. Let's fix it. Let's find ways. Let's fix it. Well, now the kiddo's spiraling into some kind of more serious issues. So acceptance actually also helps prevent some more serious mental health concerns down the line, like anxiety and depression, low self-esteem, because they accept who they are. And guess what? My baseball team accepts who I am too. And so it doesn't mean that I can't play baseball. It doesn't mean that I can't try out for the cheer squad or the play. We're all accepting each other. And if I need to do something a little bit different, that's accepted. That's okay. But I can still pursue, my dreams and ideals as well.
Yeah, and I don't see these things as two sides of a scale. I don't see treatment being on one side and acceptance on the other, and it just being out of balance constantly. I think that if you're doing appropriate treatment, and I'll put it in the behavioral world, if you're doing appropriate behavioral work, you have a lens towards what's empowering for this child, what's important for this child, what does this child want to be able to do with their life. And you're right. Establishing those skills in the framework of, I'm empowering them to be able to do and improve on their life every single day in the way that they want to. And I'm not changing them. I'm not fixing them. I'm empowering skill sets, which I do for my own children. I do for, it's that same concept. But so if you were to talk.
Can I add one thing?
Yeah,
one thing absolutely. To that, Jeff? So, you know, another thing that I share a lot with families when I'm going over the results and giving feedback is I like to help families keep in mind the idea of happy, healthy, and successful for the individual. So if you have a kiddo who's happy, who's healthy, and they're successful doing things that they enjoy, you're in a really good spot. And I think, you know, parents of all kids probably want that for their children, because success sometimes gets confused with having a high power job or being able to buy a house or something like that. And then happiness gets confused too with, you know, going out all the time and having lots of friends. And that's, it's different for everyone. So I always encourage families to keep those three things in mind for how that fits for the family and how that fits for their child. And if those are in line, they're probably on the right track. So sorry for interrupting.
And quite frankly, I think that that is absolutely what all families should be doing. But I'd love to actually put the platform back on you again and ask for, I guess, your last kind of advice for schools and clinicians, because families can't do this on their own. It takes the entire community that's going to be a part of that child's life to do it successfully, to prevent that the long-term mental health needs because somebody's been told that they're devalued or that what they're doing is wrong forever. And so how do you make sure, how would you communicate with a teacher or a clinician to ensure that same possibility?
You know, my really lofty goal is that, you know, in education programs, so med schools and schools of education, that there are more classes about autism spectrum disorder and understanding it as a spectrum and recognizing, you know, red flags. We also talk about pink flags in the psychology field of they're not quite as, you know, apparent, but they're definitely things we want to pay attention to. So if I had a magic wand, that would definitely be something that I would do, is just kind of put those programs into the training, because if someone has the training in it, they're going to carry that to their next profession. So they're going to carry it to the school system that they're in. And they're going to say, hey, I took a class or I took a course. I had a semester and let me share this with you. And same thing for the pediatricians. They're going to maybe share that with their pediatric group or share that with some of the residents that they're working with. Oh, you know what? Maybe we should think about it from this lens. So just exposure to the diagnosis kind of in those educational years, I think can be really helpful.
Well, I wish I could find your magic wand, because if everybody could go with that philosophy, this would be a wonderful place. But Dr. Young, I appreciate you giving us your time today and sharing all of the valuable insight that you have on both acceptance and abuse and, you know, where those things conflict. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to Autism Weekly. We hope you tune back in next week to learn more about autism in the real world. Autism Weekly is now found on all the major listening apps, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Subscribe to be notified when we post a new podcast. Autism Weekly is produced by ABS Kids. ABS Kids is proud to provide diagnostic assessments and ABA therapy to children with developmental delays like autism spectrum disorder. You can learn more about ABS Kids and the Autism Weekly podcast by visiting abskids.com. Thanks for tuning in. See you again next week.